one American at a time.
Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
So last week we had Robert Hastings. He's author of UFOs and Nukes, concentrating primarily on UFOs seen in and around nuclear installations, primarily in the USA, but also some cases around the world. And he has an incredible knowledge of everything about that. So when you talk to him specifically of anything that relates to that, he has it all. He's been studying this stuff for more than 30 years. The only concern I have about investigations of that nature, Chris, is whether or not it leads to tunnel vision. If you focus so much on your specialty, then suddenly maybe you're missing things around the periphery.
Yeah, that's, you know, always a... you know, a possible kind of stumbling block. But I think in Robert's case, he's really grounded. He seems to have a very good objective sense about his work. He does keep up to speed, I think, in the field in general, unlike some people who tend to really, like you say, specialize and focus in on a single aspect. But I really enjoyed the show, and I really, you know, admire, you know, 4 decades worth of work that he's put into it. And it's unfortunate that he has his Emma Woods OCD character out there that's been dogging him. Maybe there's something to it. I think an article came out last week pertaining to that particular controversy of this Carlson character. I'm going to start calling him Emma Carlson.
For those who wonder what we're talking about here, there's a character who calls herself Emma Woods, who has been stalking UFO abduction researcher David Jacobs for several years. That doesn't mean she doesn't have a case or anything, but she's gotten so obsessive about this stalking that it destroys whatever case she might have. It really does.
The whole anonymity thing really bothers me. She's put up a website. She posts on tons of boards, all under a pseudonym, all for the sole purpose of bringing down David Jacobs. And I don't agree, like you mentioned about yourself, I don't agree with a lot of Jacobs' conclusions. I do have a sense that they're rather fear-based, but I don't think anybody should have to go through what he's been going through with this woman. I mean, sure, he set himself up doing hypnotic regressions over the phone, long distance, that sort of thing, but it's getting to the point of beyond ridiculousness when somebody is just on a vendetta to just slag you in every which way possible. So, oh well, just much luck to Hastings and his Emma Carlson and David Jacobs and his Emma Woods.
Well, Jacobs told me last I heard from him via email that he was working on a more extensive rebuttal to her claims. So maybe that will put the matter to rest, but I kind of doubt it, although yeah. Things have been pretty quiet. I think part of the reason things are pretty quiet is more and more forums will not allow Emma Woods to post until she present some authentication as to who she really is.
Yeah.
I mean, you can attack anybody from the position of anonymity, but you're attacking them by name. It's not two anonymous people attacking each other. And you have to think, too, what can she fear in terms of repercussions? Because Jacobs knows who she is. She has certainly identified herself to a few of the people who support her. I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't raise that hornet's nest. Let's let sleeping dogs lie. But, you know, here at the Paracast, we have our own group of house critics. In large part, we ignore them. I seldom respond to them. I don't think you have more than once or twice in your fabulous, faded career here.
I do try to stay above the fray. I try to chip in my 2 cents wherever I think it might be appropriate, and maybe give people a little extra, you know, angle to look at a particular topic or issue. But this whole idea of hiding behind avatars and anonymous names, I've always had a problem with it. Of course, you and I, when we post, everybody knows who we are. But, you know, you get some of these people with these anonymous tags, and I think it emboldens them to get outside of themselves and and be, I think, a little bit more strident than maybe they normally would. I can't recall who told me the story, but they were able to find out who a person was that was dogging them anonymously online, and they showed up at their house and freaked them out. I'd never go to that to those lengths, but it is, you know, I'm willing to put my reputation, you know, in my anonymity to rest and just be who I am. And I think more people out there should do that. And this whole excuse of, well, if my job found out I was posted on a UFO board, I'd get fired. I mean, that's just a convenient excuse. I think we're farther down the road than having to be too concerned about that, unless you're some, you know, lead scientist at a national lab. Maybe then you'd have something to worry about. But for the most part, I don't think people really have that excuse to hang their anonymity on anymore. I think it's this whole subject is pretty much mainstream now, and we need to move forward and, you know, everybody step up and, you know, claim their opinions and stand behind them as a real person instead of an anonymous avatar and tag.
And, of course, if you are a woman living in disability in New Zealand, do you think the paparazzi is going to basically fly across the ocean and seek you out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, man.
It's going to happen.
Beat a path through the sheep herds to her door.
Ah, well, that could be.
What is New Zealand? New Zealand's up there. There's more sheep than humans. And I think, well, what's the saying? The men are men, the women are men, and the sheep are all nervous? Bad joke.
I will not say anything because they claim I tell bad jokes. But the real truth is I don't tell jokes. Occasionally I'll throw one of these old disc jockey puns out. But I do not tell jokes. I want to tell you one thing very quickly about old stuff or an old story. Lately, I've been coming across old friends that I knew in the early stages of my radio career, such as a guy named Bob Kite or RJ Kite, who does now the announcing for some of our bumpers over on the Tech Night Owl Live. And some of you who notice or care about these things, you notice on our theme song we have a new voice there. But he's somebody I've known for many years, Bob Zanotti, who actually ran a paranormal radio show on a college station in New Jersey years ago. I was a guest on the show, and now after all these years, I guess he sought us out, and he graciously agreed to do those introductions for the show, Bob Zanotti.
He lent us his manly voice.
He did indeed, and he's a professional voiceover artist, as you can tell from the quality of what he does. But he also has a great collection of the old shows that he did featuring famous UFO personalities who are no longer here. And kind of hoping that we'll get together with Bob in the very near future and get some of this stuff back on the air. I guess he has to digitize the old cassettes and reel-to-reel tape files or something. We'll get them on the air. You'll hear people like August C. Roberts, Dominic Lucchesi, and other people no longer with us, forgotten figures in the UFO field, and perhaps they had very fascinating things to say. We're also hoping to put together a show on Long John Nebel. Now, his shows go back to the 50s. I don't know if there's any copyright or heirs to Long John who might object if we ran segments on the air. We'll have to check about permissions. But I'd love to do that because I think a lot of fascinating things happen there. And maybe listeners then can judge fairly whether or not we've learned anything about paranormal investigations, specifically UFO investigations. In any case, Chris, you set up this week's show, and it's all about a book. And let me give you the name of the book, and then you can explain what this is going about. It's called How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. Well, what the heck is that about?
Well, it's a long story, and I'm sure David Kaiser is going to give us a really good, entertaining overview of this wonderful saga that's been going on, still going on, actually, to this day. But in the early 70s, there were a group of, shall we say, alternative-thinking physicists, Jack Sarfati, Nick Herbert, Paul Sarag, Fred Allen Wolfe. There was a whole group of these guys that were real radical sort of new thinking physicist, you know, quantum physicist, and they loosely formed a group called the fundamental physics group. Of course, fundamental and physics are misspelled with F's instead of PH's and stuff. And they were rumored to imbibe in quite a wide assortment of psychedelics, as was the custom at the time. And there's some question. This is one thing I want to bring up with Kaiser. I mean, what role did the psychedelics play in these in their thinking, because they came up with some radical ideas, including faster than light communication. And
subspace.
The book is fascinating.
Yeah, that's going to be David Kaiser coming up next on
The Paracast.
I've got to tell you about this. GoToMeeting by Citrix, the way I meet online with my colleagues, has just added high-definition group video conferencing. It's called GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Now you can collaborate with anyone around the world face-to-face. And I've used GoToMeeting HD Faces because it's awesome. You see the facial expressions, and that can express so much more than words. And of course, the video quality is so clear and natural, it's got the highest resolution in the industry. Nothing compares. GoToMeeting with HD Faces will make your online meetings even more personal, engaging, and effective. Plus, it's so easy to use. All you need is an internet connection and a webcam. I want you to try GoToMeeting with HD Faces. My listeners can try it free for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. Use the promo code PODCAST. The promo code is PODCAST at GoToMeeting.com.
On the average, Americans work between 45 to 50 years, hoping to build up enough wealth to retire and live out their golden years. Unfortunately, with taxation, the rising cost of food, energy, housing, and medical, many retirees are forced to live below the poverty line. Is this a flaw for enterprise, or is our monetary unit we call the Federal Reserve Note forcing us into perpetual debt, ensuring inflation and higher taxes? These questions and more can be answered by reading G. Edward Griffin's book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. Congressman Ron Paul states, "It's what every American needs to know about central bank power. A gripping adventure into the secret world of international banking cartel." Hi, this is Ted Anderson. I will give a silver dollar from the early 1900s to anyone who purchases this book. Call 1-800-686-2237 and order a copy today. It's critical that the public be made aware of the system. Call and order your copy today at 1-800-686-2237. That's 1-800-686-2237.
Are you tired of spending money for metal canning lids year after year? Then stop! Stop buying metal lids and get Tatler reusable canning lids. Made of USDA and FDA-approved food-grade plastic, Tatler canning lids let you safely store emergency preparedness foods for years. Traditional metal lids are single-use throwaways that contain BPA, but Tatler canning lids are indefinitely reusable and guaranteed to last a lifetime when used as designed for home canning and contain no BPA. Tatler lids are dishwasher safe, perfect for standard pressure or water bath canning, eliminate food spoilage from acid corrosion, fit standard mason jars, and are proudly made in the USA. Place orders by phone at 877-747-2793 or go to reusablecanninglids.com. That's 1-877-747-2793 or go to reusablecanninglids.com. That's reusablecanninglids.com. Tatler Reusable Canning Lids, the original since 1976.
If you're concerned about radiation poisoning from Japan in the air, water, or food and can't find potassium iodide, go to RestoreYourHealthNow.com and choose Liquid Zeolite. Liquid Zeolite is hands down the best product to remove radiation from your body and safely removes toxins, heavy metals, boosts energy levels, and promotes a strong immune system. For fatigue, muscle weakness, headaches, memory loss, influenza, joint pain, or toxic radiation poisoning, use Liquid Zeolite from RestoreYourHealthNow.com. Liquid Zeolite is so powerful it was used to clean up contamination in Chernobyl, yet so gentle you won't even know you're taking it. Liquid Zeolite comes with a money-back guarantee, but is only available at RestoreYourHealthNow.com. Learn how to get free bottles of Liquid Zeolite at RestoreYourHealthNow.com. That's RestoreYourHealthNow.com or call 800-880-9976. Call 800-880-9976 today and learn how to get free bottles of Liquid Zeolite.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We want to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com. Get in on all the action at forum.theparacast.com.
Hey, we're back at the Paracast with Gene and Chris, and it's my pleasure to announce and introduce to the audience our today's guest, which is David Kaiser. He's an MIT graduate, and he's written a very provocative book that I read a review of the book, and David, I just instantly knew that we should get you on the show and talk about this. It's a little bit outside of our normal purview, which is the paranormal. But when you look at people like Jack Sarfati and Nick Herbert, these guys are they're pretty paranormal in their own way. So I thought that this would be a good opportunity to open up our subject matter on the show and get you on. I really enjoyed the book. It was very entertaining. You were able to take pretty complex subject matter and present it in an easy to understand layman, for the average layman. There's a little math in there, but nothing, you know, it's not rocket science. Just the whole way that you were able to present this wonderful process that these gentlemen went through, these scientists went through, and are still going through to some extent. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, later on in the show, what some of these gentlemen are up to. But why don't you give us a little background on yourself and tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself, but also how you became involved in writing this book, How the Hippies Saved Physics.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I should start off with just a quick correction. Actually, I'm not an MIT graduate, but I do teach there now, so I'm trying to make more MIT graduates, but anyway.
I want to ask you a fast question then. We have a controversy in the paranormal field about a guy named Philip Imbrogno who claims he went to MIT. Did you ever hear of him?
I haven't, but that's not conclusive either way.
Well, they haven't either. That's the problem. Go ahead, please.
I see. Okay. So I was just going to say that, you know, right now I am a professor at MIT. I teach both in the program in science, technology, and society, and also in the Department of Physics. And I came to this topic, the way the book really got started was, you know, as a high school kid, I was an avid reader, popular science books. I wanted to read everything I could get my hands on about modern physics. And among the many, many, you know, kind of paperbacks that I got really excited about as a kid, one was Fritjof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics. That book is probably well known to many of your listeners. Runaway, amazing, you know, international blockbuster bestseller these days. It turns out that's not how it started out, but that's certainly where it is today. And so I read that book as a kid, and to be honest, I wasn't all that excited or really into the kind of Eastern spirituality side, but I was really enamored of his explanations, his introduction to ideas from relativity, from quantum theory, and that book really, really stuck with me. When I got to college, I got really excited about the notion of Bell's theorem and quantum entanglement. I'm sure we'll talk about it in some detail later on, but that was the sort of quantum weirdness, the notion that quantum theory is painting a picture for us of the world that just seems so out of whack with our intuitions and with what we're used to. That was really captivating. I mean, that really grabbed me. And then in grad school, I was working on my physics dissertation. I had the opportunity to do a benchtop experiment on entanglement on Bell's theorem. It turns out the very first version of that experiment was done by a physicist named John Clauser. And when I did a little more digging, it turns out Clauser had done that experiment in Berkeley in the 70s. Fritjof Capra, who wrote The Tao of Physics, was also in Berkeley in the 70s around that same time. And in fact, they knew each other. They were both members of this little weird kind of eccentric ragtag group. They called themselves the Fundamental Physics Group, and that's the group that I really focus on for this book. So in hindsight, you know, there are many kind of, you know, arrows along the way that led me to this group and to try to write that book.
Well, first of all, you know, Bell's theorem really does play an important, it's a pivotal subject in the book and in these scientists' process. Why don't you give us kind of a layman's thumbnail sketch of what Bell's theorem is so our listeners can understand how these guys were so excited and inspired to work in this realm?
Sure. Bell's theorem is one of these, you know, quintessential examples of just quantum weirdness. It's on a level with Schrodinger's cat, or, you know, you name your favorite weird thought experiment. So Bell's theorem is named for physicist John Bell. He published it in a really totally obscure journal in 1964, got completely ignored by physicists for a long time. But the group in Berkeley that I write about, they were among the earliest to really pick up on this and get excited. So Bell's theorem seems to suggest that quantum particles that have interacted at some point in the past, in all kinds of actually pretty mundane ways, nothing fancy about it, that they can retain a kind of connection with each other, even if those particles have moved arbitrarily far apart. So what it seems to imply is if we sort of tickle a particle here, we make some measurement on an electron, completely mundane, straightforward thing, it should make its partner particle dance instantly, instantaneously, even if that particle is, you know, a galaxy away. It boggles the mind that these two things, which are no longer in contact with each other, they stopped interacting long ago, and yet they can retain this almost like a kind of telepathic style link. At least that's when people struggle to put those equations into words, they come up with words like that. There's a weird connection between them that is really not like what we would see around us, at least in the ordinary world. So Bell's theorem is one of these examples where the quantum world can just depart really quite radically from our expectations.
So this is really a bellrock sort of foundation to quantum entanglement, I think would be the term.
In fact, that's right. That's basically synonymous. Bell's theorem nowadays is often known as quantum entanglement or non-locality. These are all basically pointing to the same idea.
Well, what about it? I mean, let's start kind of at the beginning. Why don't you give us a sense of who these fundamental physics groups were, who the individuals were, and kind of let's set the stage a little bit about the times around that the Bay Area. These are wild and woolly times, and these guys, I think it's safe to say that they were quite psychedelically aware. I'm sure they were doing psychedelics like most people of their age at that time. Why don't you give us a sense of how this group got together, you know, the struggles that they had in the beginning of their process, and sort of give us a sense of the, you know, the landscape there.
Sure, yeah. You know, the group that they formed, they called themselves, it's a very playful title, the Fundamental Physics Group. They spelled physics with an F. They're clearly having a good time. And it really had a core of maybe 8 or 10 members. The group the weekly meetings would grow or contract. It could be as many as 40 or 50, but there were really about 8 or 10 of them who kind of saw it through every week for about, you know, almost 4 years. So it was a long, long-running, informal, but long-running group. And like you say, these were basically folks who were largely down on their luck at the time. They had, almost all of them had completed PhDs in physics from some of the nation's most elite, you know, premier graduate programs. These were incredibly well-trained, smart physicists, you know, places like Columbia and Stanford and Berkeley and Illinois and, you know, you name it. But they had finished their training when the bottom fell out of the physics profession. It was an incredibly hard time to get anything like a kind of standard job in physics in the early 70s. At one point in 1971, for example, there were more than 1,000 young physicists registered looking for jobs and 50 jobs on offer, 1,000 to 50. I mean, we're talking, you know, the market had just fallen through the floor. A kind of speculative bubble had burst. It's like a Bernie Madoff kind of scheme, you know.
I wanted to just mention here, it seems like we're reliving that experience today because the bottom has fallen out. Today, you have people with advanced degrees today who are lucky to get employed at a fast food restaurant for one of the same reasons. Yeah.
That's right. And so we've gone through these boom and bust cycles actually a few times in recent history, the last few decades.
I want to get into this as we progress through our segments of the show. Our guest is David Kaiser. Yes, he is a professor at MIT. You can find his name on their site. It's real. This time, we got somebody from MIT. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
Ray Perkins, a reclusive veteran burned out from the Gulf War, lives tortured by relentless, perplexing nightmares. Nightmares of a horrific battle in deep space and of a mysterious woman suffering in agony for her devastated world. A woman not yet born, calling across centuries to him. Then, a coincidence leads him to his destiny, his chance to alter the universe. Attack of the Rockoids. The former fiction editor for Star Wars and Indiana Jones, Robert Simpson, writes, "The soul of the novel Attack of the Rockoids lies in its heart and passion for building a convincing tale of a love that spans a galaxy. A thrilling story. Attack of the Rockoids is available now. Read a sample chapter and get a special discount off of the cover price at our website, rockoids.com. That's rockoids.com. Attack of the Rockoids. A novel in the grand science fiction tradition.
Ready to save? Then you're ready for the Super Summer Sale at Herbal Healer Academy. Herbal Healer has been the leader in quality natural supplements for 23 years. Log on to HerbalHealer.com and take advantage of Herbal Healer Academy's incredible savings on 500 parts per million colloidal silver. the best pharmaceutical grade available, and all sizes on sale. Super Male Plex with Uhimbe and Super Femplex for summer toning. Buy glucosamine chondroitin 60 caps, summer sale priced at only $12. Colon Enhancer 250 caps, summer sale priced at just $18. And if your brain's a little foggy, we have a great supplement on sale called Memory Power. Log on and hit the postcard specials link for more super summer savings at herbalhealer.com. As always, new customers get a free catalog with first order. Herbal Healer Academy, healing the world with nature one person at a time.
Before you throw away your used batteries, you need to listen to this. Now, going green can save money. Go green and save money by giving life to your used batteries by charging them with the Renaissance Charger. The Renaissance Charger uses a new revolutionary battery charging technology that effectively extends the life of new batteries and gives new life to used batteries. Invented by legendary audio genius John Bedini, this unique and patented charging system rejuvenates the electrochemical plate structure in the battery without additives, increasing capacity and maintaining cell integrity. Renaissance Charge offers a full line of products made in the USA for all types and sizes of batteries. Find out why our customers tell us the Renaissance Charger is the only battery charger they will ever use. Save your money. Save the environment. Visit us online at r-charge.com. That's r-charge.com or call us at 208-772-4514. That's 208-772-4514. Be a part of the revolution today.
You can't argue with success. And many people have found great success in fighting back colds and flu viruses with Ali-C, the world's best garlic extract. So now, it's time to get even more success with the other great quality natural products from Affinity Health Products. Like C-Energy Liquid Vitamins, Lose and Snooze, and the One Day Diet. Or Human Growth Hormone Support, Menopause Specialist for Women, and Joint Specialist. See these and many other quality Affinity Health products for men and women online at AffinityHealthProducts.com. That's A-F-F-I-N-I-T-Y HealthProducts.com. Or call in your orders at 877-888-7126. That's 1-877-888-7126. Trust your health to the makers of Ali-C, the world's best garlic extract. Affinity Health Products, the finest and most innovative natural health products available.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Hello, this is John Burroughs, one of the witnesses to the Rendlesham UFO incident. You're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
We're back, Gene and Chris, talking to David Kaiser, professor at MIT, author of, and let me give you the full name of the book here, How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. And right now he's talking about this culture, this group of scientists who couldn't get a job because the bottom had fallen out, I guess, of the business. And we recall also people like Stanton Friedman, nuclear physicist. He reached a situation where he couldn't find employment except as a UFO investigator. So, David Kaiser, you could have become a UFO investigator. You didn't, though.
No, not this time around. Not in this life, anyway. But it's true that the folks I focus on for the book, they had to make a different way in the world. I mean, they couldn't just do what their teacher's generation had done in terms of, you know, the expected routine. You get your PhD from a good place, you get a good job, you do, you know, mainstream research. Through no fault of their own, this generation and members like this Berkeley group, they were really just caught off guard. And so what amazed me about the story is they found each other through different ways. They kind of bumbled along, and the roads led them to Berkeley. I always joke, if it's 1973 and you got time in your hands, might as well go to Berkeley. It was a great, amazing place to be, as I'm sure we'll talk about. And once they got there, through different ways, different things that brought them there, they pretty quickly found each other, and they found kind of like-minded people who were incredibly passionate about modern physics, about what it might imply, about where it might lead, who had seen those questions really kind of denigrated in their formal training. So they were trained to be extremely good with their calculations. They could sling the equations around with the best of them, but they hadn't been encouraged, and in fact, their coursework had really discouraged any of the kind of philosophical, interpretive, what does it all mean kind of stuff, you know? And that's what this group was really hungry for. And they figured they had time on their hands. They weren't punching the clock anymore. They found each other. They had this kind of shared interest. And so they formed this very informal but very kind of spirited group, the fundamental physics group. And they met together every Friday afternoon, and they'd arrange for some speakers. They'd have kind of brainstorming sessions. And sometimes they would truck on down, bring the whole show down to the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, about 150 miles south of San Francisco, right on the coast, you know, breathtakingly beautiful setting. And Esalen, as I'm sure you know, was famous even at the time for a kind of incubator of the New Age, right? All things New Age or occult, whether it was Eastern mysticism or psychedelic drugs or yoga, which once seemed very radical, vegetarianism, things that, you know, some of which now seem actually pretty straightforward. And it turns out the single longest running seminar series in Esalen's history was actually on quantum mechanics and the nature of reality, these physicists that I wrote about were organizing every year for the better part of two decades. It was hot stuff at Esalen around the hot tubs and all the rest. So these folks were carving out a kind of parallel universe for themselves to pursue these questions that had really fallen out of favor or fallen out of the curriculum for mainstream physics.
So why don't you give us a sense of some of the early thinking that they bounced around with each other and some of the early attempts at creating hypotheses and then doing the work that it would take to prove them and get published.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things that really mesmerized the members of the group was Bell's theorem, we were just talking about a moment ago, this notion of quantum entanglement of particles that could be separated in space but still share this kind of instant connection. And they were among the earliest physicists anywhere in the world to take that seriously. They weren't the only ones, but they were, we might say, the early adopters. Go back and look at who published articles on Bell's theorem during the first 15 years after Bell's original publication, and they're dominated by members of this group. So not exclusive, but clearly, you know, in the game early. And these folks were worried about entanglement, about non-locality, about how quantum theory violates our ordinary experience. But they also, some of them, were also curious about, would this help explain other kind of strange phenomena around them? And this is where I think it matters a great deal, that they were sitting in the Bay Area in the 70s as a lot of stuff was getting attention and kind of in the air. And one topic was, for example, Uri Geller, the Israeli performer who then began to claim that he had genuine psychic abilities. He was whisked to the United States for careful scientific study. One of the first places he went to or was brought to was in the Bay Area, the Stanford Research Institute, or SRI. It was a defense contractor laboratory that had only recently been spun off from Stanford University. So ordinarily they did, you know, tests for the Pentagon or some private industry. And all of a sudden there was a group at SRI, again, sort of with time on their hands during this low point in the physics profession, and they began studying people like Geller, and in fact many other people, to see now, if they had mind-reading abilities.
Did they actually come to any conclusions, positive or negative, about these alleged abilities? This is very important.
They did. They came to the conclusions. They didn't sway everyone who tried to listen to them, but they were convinced. These are physicists Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ, and in fact, there's a whole group there at one point. They got articles into some of the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals on the planet, like the journal Nature, Proceedings of the IEEE, the Electrical Engineering Association, where they were conducting, you know, experimental tests, laboratory tests under what they considered, you know, carefully controlled conditions for people like Geller, and in fact, as I say, many others, names might not be well known today, of things like what we might casually call mind reading, telekinesis, these kinds of things. And so this was getting press not only in kind of a hip underground, you know, counterculture scene, but also front page news at the time in the San Francisco Chronicle and other, you know, kind of mainstream newspapers. And so these physicists that I wrote about who were in Berkeley, you know, some of them were reading about this stuff. They got incredibly excited. They began to wonder whether this mind reading or telepathy or, you know, ESP type stuff maybe that was an instance. Maybe that could be explained by this weird quantum thing like non-locality or entanglement. So maybe, you know, they had an extra, some of them had an extra impetus to worry about the kind of grand meaning of quantum theory, because they thought it could account for even wider ranges of phenomena like these tests at SRI. They got really invested in that.
Well, at the time, I mean, phrases like counterfactual indefiniteness and non-locality, hidden states, these are really difficult subjects and terms to communicate to people, even people with, you know, a sense of education. And these guys were, they in their own sort of, I think, unique way, let's put it, got involved in really trying to communicate these subjects. And one of the things that it's always struck me is, you know, how SRI, Targ and Puthoff got started. And of course, the early experiments with Uri Geller and Pat Price, and then later Ingo Swann, you didn't mention this, but this then gradually kind of morphed into the whole remote viewing project that then actually raised quite a lot of eyebrows, especially in the intelligence community and in the military. And these guys seem to swirl around this whole sort of cauldron of creative thinking and ideas. One of the real, I think, leading figures in this whole physics group was, of course, Jack Sarfati, who is quite a character. He's still out there. For a scientist who supposedly is doing some pretty heavy-duty physics work, I don't know how the heck he has time to fire off several hundred emails every day. And I've unfortunately been the recipient of some rather strident emails from Jack. We'd like to get Jack on the show at some point. And he has surprisingly agreed to come on the show so we can dig into some of his war stories. But, I mean, these guys are really, I mean, they were walking the walk and talking the talk. I mean, several of them actually had jobs as, like, dishwashers and just, they did anything they could to get by. Why don't you describe some of these figures for us? Nick Herbert, of course, Sarfati. Why don't you give us a little thumbnail sketch on these guys? Because some of the photographs I've seen, I mean, they look like something out of Star Wars.
Yeah. You know, I should say, so each of the people I wrote about, I guess almost all of them, are still alive. You mentioned Jack Sarfati, Nick Herbert, the whole group, in fact. I think they're flourishing, and they were extremely generous with their time for me as I was working on the book. So I got to know them, you know, at least pretty well.
Did you get a chance to, like, hang out with them, or is it mostly email and telephone?
A little bit. I mean, so I spent the better part of, you know, a really fun day in San Francisco with Jack Sarfati and Fred Allen Wolf while working on the book. John Clauser had me over at his house for a really very lovely whole long day and follow-up interviews often by telephone and email and all the rest. So these folks have really been very kind, and other physicists I write about as well, Wojciech Zurek at Los Alamos Laboratory and others who are not into the kind of counterculture scene but who play roles in the book, and they also were, you know, just extremely generous. So
we have David Kaiser, and the book is called How the Hippie Saved Physics. Well, they certainly did a lot of unusual things. We'll learn more about them. Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. You're in
the Paracast.
So here's what happened. I was placing an order online. The site went down. It just stopped responding. It took hours before it returned, but I had already placed the order with another company. If your site goes down, you could lose business. And if you have a business or personal site, you'll want to know it's easy to run and it will stay online. At iWeb, your site is hosted on one of the most reliable networks in the world. Check it out. iWeb.com. That's iWeb.com. For 58 years, Fate has provided true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate brings you the latest in all aspects of the paranormal, like angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, and much, much more. To receive your complimentary Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Local Army Navy surplus stores are hard to find these days, but not military issue supplies. They're right here online at mainmilitary.com. That's right, just like the state, M-A-I-N-E, military.com. We have everything for true total preparedness. MaineMilitary.com is not a typical website. It has much more than your old surplus store. Quality military-issue survival gear like canteens, mess kits, utensils, gas masks, filters, and chemical suits, magnesium fire-starting tools, strike anywhere, waterproof, and storm matches, first aid kits, splints, tourniquets, parachute 550 cord, military manuals, sandbags by the bale, and a huge Molly assortment of vests and pouches for every need. Call 207-989-6783, 207-989-6783, or visit MaineMilitary.com. That's M-A-I-N-E, military.com, the Maine name in military supply.
OpticsPlanet.com is where discerning gun owners and outdoorsmen go to gear up. OpticsPlanet has the best selection of rifle scopes, red dots, night vision, holsters, bags, and tactical gear on the planet. With always low prices, free shipping on most orders, and expert customer service. Go to OpticsPlanet.com/GCN to get a free gift with purchase. That's OpticsPlanet.com/GCN. Or call 800-332-OPTICS. 800-332-6784.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
Energy, energy, and more energy.
We all need it. Get the energy you need quick through the powers of wild forest extracts. Wild chaga and birch bark are the secrets of the forest, used exclusively by Russian athletes. Wild chaga is the world's top source of superoxide dismutase, the critical enzyme that blocks the aging process. Chaga is good for your heart and even helps support healthy arteries. Wild birch extract is the top source of betulin, a natural sterol needed by every cell of the body. And healthy cells mean a healthy body and a more powerful you. No wonder it's known as a king of all herbs. Experience real energy and power like you've never dreamed possible. Take Chago Charge Tea with Wild Birch Bark every day and Chagamax capsules to get the energy you need.
You deserve it.
Order today by calling 877-817-9829. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
This is Hilly Rose, and I hope that you do listen to the Paracast because you will learn a great deal about the paranormal.
Chris O'Brien's the co-host. I'm Gene Steinberg. On the Paracast, David Kaiser, who's a professor at MIT, and is talking about a group of people who hung out together in San Francisco, the hippies, how the hippies saved physics. Now, the title, Saved Physics, is it because of the cutting-edge research they discussed? How did they save physics?
It is. I mean, I intended the title to be actually kind of playful, a bit ironic, kind of tongue-in-cheek, which is like, I don't think any small group of individuals, you know, saved the entire discipline. So it's meant to be playful. Nonetheless, I mean, this group, on the margins and really, as you said, down and out, some of them living hand-to-mouth, incredibly passionate about their work, and they really did, you know, stir some pretty amazing developments. All the more amazing given their kind of, you know, professional platform at the time. And so I don't think they saved all of physics, but they did a bunch of stuff that has had lasting value to this day. And when I started piecing those things together, I said, you know, there's really a book here. And so we were starting to talk before, you know, who are these characters? People like Nick Herbert and Jack Sarfati and Fred Allen Wolf might be known, names known to some of your listeners. Elizabeth Rauscher was at the time a graduate student, a young mom raising her son, was just able to go back to finish her PhD when her child was old enough, you know, to go to kindergarten. Really, you know, not easy times. And she was subject to really quite horrible gender discrimination. Very, very few women physics students, even as recently as the 1970s. And so she didn't have an easy time of it. Saul Paul Sarag, who's an amazing fellow. He was basically, I honestly can't remember if he finished his undergraduate degree or not. He did not go on for graduate training, partly because he dropped out of Berkeley to go pursue theater. He was cast in the original Broadway production of Hair, if you can think back to that. Couldn't really scrounge up the cash to meet the actor's equity fee, went back to Berkeley to study more physics. I mean, these are amazing people and pretty cool characters. And Saul Paul, through basically self-study, managed to publish several physics articles in, again, the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals in the land. So these people combined an amazing passion for quantum theory and its kind of weirdnesses with an interest in all the kind of buzzing, blooming, occult, New Age stuff that was getting especially a lot of play in San Francisco and the Bay Area in the 70s. And they were playful. They didn't take themselves too seriously at times. And it was just pretty amazing bunch.
Well, to have seminars at Esalen naked in hot tubs, you know, that's just kind of wacky, just listening to me say that. But one of the things that you really you spend a bit of time in the book talking about Nick Herbert and Jack Sarfati's attempt at faster-than-light communication. And this was fascinating to me because basically what they were trying to do is take the principles that Bell laid out in his theorem and take non-locality and actually utilize it as an approach to faster-than-light communication. Let's talk about that a little bit because it was an incredibly difficult process that they went through. And I know Nick Herbert spent years attempting to prove his hypothesis. And why don't you give us a kind of a thumbnail on that?
And maybe you answer the question, David, consider the phrase that came out of Star Trek, subspace communications. Is that what it was about?
Subspace. I'm not sure what that would be, actually. I'm not sure.
That was the concept in the Star Trek universe. In the Star Trek universe in the 1960s, how did they communicate with people light years away? Well, of course, they didn't have to explain it. It was all subspace.
I see. Well, maybe that was the inspiration. I don't know. But it certainly is. It's equally strange about what these folks were up to or were after. And so, I mean, just to pause for a second and say, faster than light communication, what that really would imply, if one could make it work, would be receiving a message before it was sent. We're talking about all the causal paradoxes, all the kind of troubles with relativity that would imply. And so what certain members of this Berkeley group, especially at the time, Jack Sarfati and Nick Herbert, they were really intrigued by the possibility, which is to say, Bell's theorem, this incredibly beautiful result from quantum theory, not getting much attention yet, except from folks like the ones I write about. It seemed watertight. In fact, group member John Clauser had done the very first laboratory tests. It proved that this entanglement seemed to be a real thing. It wasn't just, you know, flights of fancy. And it implied this instantaneous, faster-than-light connection between two particles. And that seems to butt up against, that seems really to sit poorly with the other great pillar of modern physics, Einstein's relativity, which seems to put an absolute speed limit, an upper limit on how fast anything like information or force or anything else could travel. So here you have the great smackdown of modern physics, right? Is quantum theory going to be incompatible with relativity, or will there be some unusual and kind of hidden union between them? And that's the kind of thing that these folks are after. People like Nick Herbert and Jack Sarfati. And so they came up with increasingly really quite ingenious designs, sort of thought experiments, for devices that maybe really could use quantum theory to basically violate relativity, to send messages before they could be, or I should say, to receive messages before they were sent, to go faster than light. And so you're right, in the book I have a long chapter on the kind of cat and mouse game, as I think of it. You know, the two of them would come up with, would hammer out a cool idea. It would often get, you know, hashed out first in these informal group discussions by the fundamental physics group. They'd put them down on paper. Jack even filed patent disclosure forms at one point, thought he could maybe patent a device. Nick Herbert wrote up his own preprints and set them on their way. And then a small number of other physicists all around the world, some of them in the United States, some dotted throughout Western Europe, would get their hands on these kind of underground preprints. There were all kinds of interesting ways they were connected. And they would think hard about them, and that some of them would find the loopholes. They'd find the sort of no-go theorem, why that actually would not be able to operate as claimed. And this went on for, as you said, for years. In fact, for, you know, increasingly ingenious patterns or plans, and then increasingly subtle reasons why they actually would fall. And with each of those, these were kind of revelations that had not been known before about the deep structure of quantum theory. Physicists were learning about things they didn't even know about from in the effort to kind of debunk or poke holes in these cool designs. And so, and from that's partly where the saving physics in the title comes from. Out of that really quite playful, spirited back and forth came some absolutely critical insights into physics that that are at the sort of page one of our textbooks today. They go by names like the no cloning theorem, the no signaling theorem, quantum limits on amplifiers. I mean, these are foundational results that are now at the bedrock of a multi-billion-dollar industry like quantum encryption, and they were discovered by the kind of constant, playful, smart prodding and hard thinking by people like Jack Sarfati and Nick Herbert, and then the handful of their kind of interlocutors, people like Wojciech Zurek and Bill Wooters and Dennis Deeks and others, Giancarlo Girardi. So there was this kind of really attenuated communication pattern between the kind of really hip, playful Berkeley group and a few other kind of increasingly mainstream physicists who were paying attention.
Cutting to the chase, David, is it possible to have what we call subspace communications or communications at faster than light speed so someone who's exploring another star system can call home and they get an answer right away, not 50 years from now?
When E.T. calls home. So to the best of my knowledge, the answer is no. I think most physicists would say no. On the other hand, I'm not going to endorse these plans, but serious people, you know, have given serious thought to, and continue to that question. And so it wouldn't surprise me if the effort to get even more wacky, cool ideas today would A, not work, but B, be sort of clarifying in the quest, much like it had happened before. And so quantum theory, if, as we now understand it, seems not to allow these things to happen. Is quantum theory the last word? You know, there are all kinds of legitimate reasons to ask about extensions beyond quantum theory or, for that matter, relativity. So given what we know now, I think the answer really is no, we can't do it. Do I think that'll never, ever, ever be possible? You know, that's a much harder bet to place.
Of course, I have to ask then about the logical connection, warp drive, hyperdrive, or as they used to say, engage. So can we engage warp drive? They're talking about that, aren't they?
Some of the folks are today. So, for example, people like Jack Sarfati have been working very hard on sort of, we might call them exotic theories of space-time, or worrying about, or even does Einstein's general relativity allow for exotic states and so on. So again, it's not that I at least haven't seen a winning example yet, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be working on it. And that's I think the larger point of the book is that we need these people, we need all kinds of people, to be pushing and pushing on the boundaries. What seems just maybe barely possible, because just in clarifying, even if it's impossible, we're going to learn something, and often we'll learn pretty surprising and amazing things.
But isn't that part of doing scientific research, that today something is impossible, but tomorrow we find a way to do it? That's the way it's always been, hasn't it?
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the favorite examples that these folks used to trot out even back in the day was that at one point John Wheeler, a very, very prominent, eminent physicist, who was in very frequent contact with the Berkeley group, at one point he called one of their ideas moonshine. And they thought that was great because that's exactly the word that was used before World War II to explain, to dismiss the notion of what would become an atomic bomb. You know, a Nobel laureate nuclear physicist had said that's, you know, uranium fission is just moonshine.
And I'll tell you what, we'll drink more moonshine or the Kool-Aid or whatever it is with David Kaiser. I'm Gene Steinberg. The co-host is Chris O'Brien. You're in
the Paracast.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you'd like to listen to GCN programs on the go, I have great news. GCN has created a Droid and iPhone application, and it's free. Just as easy as going to GCNlive.com, click on the banner, and download. Before you know it, you'll be listening to your favorite hard-hitting GCN shows, live or on demand, right on your Droid or iPhone, 24/7 and on the go. So download the Droid and iPhone app free by clicking on the banner at GCNlive.com. Thanks again for listening to GCNlive.com. Again, that's GCNlive.com.
We the people grow cotton, weave fabric, engrave ink, embed strips and fibers to protect from counterfeit, then carting to a private bank, having it lent back at interest, forcing taxes to service debt. This capitalism, or was Jefferson correct when stating a central bank issuing the public currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army? Ted Anderson, I'm placing a free silver dollar in a book that explains our monetary system. Call for your copy, 800-686-2237. It's time to understand the system. Call 800-686-2237. That's 800-686-2237.